Italian immigration to the United States peaked in the early 1900s, meaning most Italian Americans are several generations removed from the mother country. But Americans are still obsessed with things Italian, from mobster movies to Milanese shoes. Duke University English professor Tom Ferraro is here to talk about Italian cultural identity today. Tom Ferraro, welcome.
Thank you, Frank.
Great to have you on the program. His new book is called Feeling Italian, The Art of Ethnicity in America. And we're taking your phone calls and emails as well, 877-962-9862 or SOT@WUNC.org for all of the tens of millions of Italian Americans here in the Tar Heel State. No, that's not true, is it, Tom? But we're talking today about ethnic identity and about the identification with Italians among non-Italians. And Tom, you have Italian roots yourself. Now, why isn't your book titled Being Italian rather than Feeling Italian?
Well, one of the things that I'm interested in, Frank, is the combination of the energy of Italian ways of doing or Italian-descended ways of doing that permeate things that we don't name as Italian. So that's one half. And the other half is what I take to be by your sweet introduction. The central notion that we have forms of Italian identity that come to us as participants through media forms, through film, through a sense of American identity that is acquired by the imagination.
Well, what are some of those things? I mean, some of those things that we adopt or that non-Italians love to sort of pick up on and take on as their own.
Well, I'm thinking about food ways. I'm thinking about the ways in which you can meet young people who have an entire imaginative universe organized around mafia flicks. I'm thinking about the force of Madonna in the 1980s and what she did for an entire generation or two of young women caught between a version of feminism that was seemed to throw out the women with the bathwater, as it were, and a backlash that wanted to go back to the 1950s.
Then you talk too about Mario Puzo's novel. You mentioned The Godfather. What impact do you think that novel had on the American imagination when it was published in the 1960s?
This is a long story. The shortest version is that when The Godfather came on in 1969, the way in which the American success story was told, it was a story that we know from Gatsby. You're essentially an orphan, and as you rise, you lose your cultural form. You're cut off from family. You're cut off from ethnicity. You're cut off from whatever the old ways are, and overnight. The Godfather transformed not only our understanding of what a mobster was, a mobster being the lone individual, but our understanding of how ethnicity worked in relationship to capitalism, the big family entrepreneur in which the business is run as a family and the family is run as if it was a business.
Let's listen to a clip from The Godfather. In this scene, Michael Corleone is talking with his brother Fredo.
Fredo. You're my older brother, and I love you. But don't ever take sides with anyone against the family again. Ever.
Yeah, of course, we know that Fredo does wind up sleeping with the fishes, but here it is, this sense of family devotion, loyalty to the family, and sort of the ultimate capitalist ethos. Don't turn your back on the family business.
Yeah, the whole way the first Godfather film operates, which is taken from the main narrative line of the novel, is to imagine a crisis in the family. Who's going to what son will be the patriarch, and a crisis in the business. Who's going to take over? There's a hostile takeover bid by the Barzini Tartaglia consortium. And what Puzo did was imagine a plot in which you would satisfy the two problems at the same time. Michael Corleone would return to the family, the prodigal son, and he would rebuild the power, the New York-based power. Unfortunately, there went Carlo Rizzi, the brother-in-law. And in that moment, Puzo registers the difficulty that you get into if you really do try to run your family as if it was a business.
Yeah, it does sort of. In fact, it reminds me of the one of the initial stories that you tell about an early immigrant, Maria Barbella, and how she brought her culture with her. And Americans weren't quite ready to accept that in her story.
Well, what Maria Barbella was a seamstress who, after a month of being unchaste with the neighborhood Lothario, found herself with a dead boyfriend on the floor of a cafe, and this is in 1896 in Mulberry Street in the center of Five Points. 3 months later, this woman who had been in the States for only a year from Basilicata and had only a regional dialect, had no English, found herself sentenced to die in the electric chair. She was going to be the first woman to die.
Hold the story. I want to come back to it and see how the myth of Italian culture meshes with the reality and how it's been reimagined in American culture. As we talk today with Duke University English professor Tom Ferraro is with us. His book, Feeling Italian, The Art of Ethnicity in America, and your phone calls at 877-962-9862. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. We're talking today about being Italian and feeling Italian in North Carolina. Author Tom Ferraro joins us. He feels Italian while teaching at Duke, and his book has that in his title, Feeling Italian, The Art of Ethnicity in America. Taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862. Did you give your kids an Italian name because they sounded cool? Our producer did, and she's not Italian. 877-962-9862. What is it about the Italian mystique that draws you to the culture? Give us a call, 877-962-9862, or send us an email at sot@wunc.org. So before the break, Tom, we're talking about Maria Barbella, who is an Italian immigrant circa the turn of the century. She kills this cad who had been abusing her. He had been taking advantage of her, had no intention of marrying her, and kills her. And she finds herself now part of the American legal system, having come from a very different system of justice in Italy.
Yes, what happens are two trials. In the first trial, she's the defense attorney with no prep, the public attorney, tries to explain that having lost her honor, she could not go home, and that under the false pretenses that the local Southern Italian immigrants assumed that, in fact, it was a revenge motive, but that she had done the right thing. This got nowhere. This got her to Sing Sing. A year later, there was a sensational second trial in which an epilepsy defense was used. It resulted in her being exonerated before the law, and there's a sort of standard issue way of telling the story where you explain the multiple set of victimizations, and what you foreground is the American justice system finally doing the right thing. There's another story. There was a hidden piece of information, amongst other things, Maria Barbella was in her late 20s, not in her early 20s when this happened. This was her last chance for love, and the story is a story ultimately, I believe, and I think so does Adana Pucci, the amazing researcher who did the work on this, believed that it was an act of vengeance, and that the Johnny Cochran, Alan Dershowitz team of the 1890s, as well as the astounding feminists who came to her, were doing an act of mercy, an act of mercy that resulted in her being freed.
And it's, again, a look at what the reality of a criminal justice system, if we want to call it that, in Italy, and one that Americans really couldn't adopt in its form, so had to sort of adapt to it. And you say The Godfather does the same. In fact, you say The Godfather in many ways replaced the Western as this kind of iconic form of the sort of upwardly mobile story in America.
Yeah, well, what happens? Puzo, having written two astoundingly good small novels, including one about his mother called The Fortunate Pilgrim, writes the Godfather as a popular text, but he hits upon a set of narrative conventions, a storytelling regime that has launched a thousand creative ships. We have film after film, crescendoing into The Sopranos, which for 6 or 7 years now has been the greatest Dickensian work of art, produced by not an American, but by teams of Americans, many of whom with affinal relations, that is, genealogical relations to this world, but many of them not.
And has The Sopranos, do you think, changed the image of the mafia family, or does it just play on some of the same ideas, same stereotypes?
Oh, no. I think what it has done is it's made it suburban. It's a very interesting thing. The Sopranos, the sort of visual culture of The Sopranos is that of post-industrial New Jersey. But its geography is ultimately domestic. It's set in one of the upper end North Jersey suburbs, and it's a narrative for the small screen, not the big screen. And it's issues of what do you do when your aging mother is going to set the house on fire and is running over one of her good friends. You have to do something. This is not. Most of us weren't part of an effort to become larger than AT&T, but this business and the domestic business of the Prozac era, that's The Sopranos, and that's where we are now.
And you also talked about in the book the commodification of Italian identity, and I suppose a movie like Moonstruck is a pretty good example of that. Given the ethnicity of the people who actually worked on that film and what it represents.
Yes, it's one of the interesting things what larger percentage of Brooklynite Italian Americans really like this. Moonstruck. Why would that be? It is almost partly it's a function of its own self-reflexivity. The movie is tongue-in-cheek throughout. It combines Toronto locales and it moves Ferrara's pastry shop into Brooklyn. Everybody in New York knows that Ferrara's pastry shop is not in Brooklyn, and yet somehow it captures that sort of the romantic melodrama of an emergent Italian-American middle class coming out of working class roots.
And you talked, too, about this commodification as something, in a sense where the story has been abducted. That can be, and some Italian-Americans, I suppose, could object to that. But the big objection is among many Italian-Americans that they're constantly cast in these stereotypes and that they're having to live down the stereotypes in The Godfather and in The Sopranos. And they get angry about that. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think 30 years ago, there was still a lot of haunting. Double hauntings. If you think of the mob issues, it's a double haunting. People still lived in neighborhoods where you didn't talk about these things, and for good reason. But as soon as they got out of the neighborhoods, there was the tag, and Italians were not found in law firms and corporate boardrooms. Things have changed. Things have changed mightily. You can spearhead the revival of a public radio as a talking discipline at the University of North Carolina in Durham, and still have Italian American roots. This is another moment, and while some people are haunted, I think in general we're at a place, we're at a moment in time when one doth protest too much, particularly when something like The Sopranos. If Shakespeare was alive today, you might say Shakespeare was Alan Sorkin, but you also might say that Shakespeare is David Chase, working under time pressure in a popular medium, but producing producing eloquence and a knowledge of the human condition that speaks enormous volumes.
Well, you talked, too, about this haunting, and it seemed to me that it worked both ways because Frank Sinatra, who you also write about in the book as one of these iconic figures, certainly in the Italian-American culture, was in many ways embraced because of his gangster reputation, because of his gangster connections, but I guess only because he was able to transcend them at the same time.
Well, I think it there's a popular fascination with, as well as Italian-American irritation for some Italian-Americans, particularly those who are upwardly mobile, with the fact that Sinatra was a little too publicly friendly with Sam Giancana. On the other hand, the mob had nothing to do with what happened with that voice. And that voice brought, on the one hand, that voice is a voice that can be celebrated by the New Yorker as having a form of eloquence unprecedented. At the same time, part of that eloquence is this kind of double teasing. He teases the form that he revived, and he teases the folks back at home in Hoboken who are feeling sorry for themselves because they don't, you know, quite have the chutzpah. We need to be multi-ethnic in the way we say these things, to do what Sinatra had done, which is to say to myself, well, I'm not sure whether I've got a good voice, but this doesn't seem that hard.
Let's take some phone calls. We're talking with Thomas Ferraro. Feeling Italian, The Art of Ethnicity in America is his new book. And Aaron is on the line from Chapel Hill. Hello, Aaron.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I'm calling because I was very surprised you haven't spoken about food yet. I grew up in upstate New York with my mom's big Italian family, and food is certainly what I identify with.
Well, there's a way in which each of the sections of the book that I've written tries to emulate the ethos that's in play. And the last full chapter is on Stanley Tucci and Scott Campbell's Big Night, which I argue is a film good enough to eat. And a film it's a film. Tony Shalhoub of Lebanese descent is the star of this thing. And Campbell Scott, you cannot even remember what his name is unless you remember that he's George C. Scott's son, because he is so waspy the name is reversible. And yet the film has a sort of the film performs. Not only it performs the love that goes into the making of the food, the community that is produced, the communion that is produced out of the partaking of the food, and the ethical responsibility that comes from having sat at table.
And there has to be a correlation there because everybody does. Everybody loves Italian food, and the world over, and it certainly is the most popular and identifiable part of Italian culture. And as you said, it's that nurturing. It is perhaps the culture most closely identified with, among other Mediterranean cultures, with a food nurturing culture. It's about the table. It's about the dinner. It's about mama saying, mangia, mangia.
And about the obligations that come from once you sat at table.
That's right. Yeah, she'll never let you know it. As my grandmother always used to say, eat, it's no good tomorrow. And it didn't matter what it was. It's no good tomorrow. And I'm going to throw it away, she'd say. 877-962-9862 to call in and talk with Tom Ferraro, Feeling Italian, The Art of Ethnicity in America. And we're, you know, talking about Frank Sinatra just a minute ago, this business of the gangster reputation, about a guy who kind of sings about it, overcomes it, makes fun of it in many ways. Disarms the ethnic epithets by overusing them. It seems to me a lot of correlations in parallel with hip hop culture and music.
Well, the one of the larger quiet ambitions of the book is to set a way in which to make it understood that that America becomes more Italian. Even as the Italians become more American, there has been hip-hop is just the latest manifestation of the African Americanization of the U.S., in which music is beginning with the blues through jazz, that America takes it up and somehow becomes something different than it was before.
And this is a process that, as we've said, we've talked about it in terms of Italian-American complaint. We've also heard it among some African Americans that this commodification or co-opting of the culture is something that's objectionable. But do you find it that, or is this do you see it more as a process of renewal, of making it new?
Well, what do you do with Duke Ellington? It's the same issue as with Sinatra. There are ways in which Dean Martin had a more playfully ordinary Italian-American attitude, including, I'm just singing, it's just song. Sinatra took it really seriously. Ellington took forms of African-American dance music and produced a publicly accessible band sound that is also a work of genius. And I think trying to fight over which is more authentic or not is self-defeating.
And the other aspect I think that both have in common is the fact that they come out of real poverty and a sense of oppression, being the hated class for a time in American culture. And that's where the music springs from. That's where the art and cultures come from.
Yeah, because it's both. It has this double-edgedness. It's an effort to own part of the culture that you haven't owned before, but also to bring the wisdom of the fight to get that ownership into romantic song.
So that's what the artist does. That's what the Italian or African American artist will do in expressing themselves in whatever form it takes. Why does the American culture, the dominant culture that seems to loathe poverty, criminalize poverty, also find itself so utterly fascinated with it?
Well, it depends on which dimension you have in front of yourself. I think one of the things that Puzo brought, an irony that's in his voice, that he narrates in The Godfather, and that then reappears in the imaginative gestalt that he and Coppola crafted for the film, is a sense that of love and irony at the same time, that respect is also partly fear, and that we're attracted. You know, Americans are supposed to be famously innocent, and sometimes in our conduct in certain places we are too innocent. But there's an element in our art and imaginative life that understands that blood can be bloody, that genealogy and destructiveness can go hand in hand.
Well, let me ask you this, though. What do you think about the future of ethnicity? We always talk about these sort of one ethnic group replacing the next. Have we come to the sort of postmodern age in ethnicity? Have we come to the end of ethnicity?
Frank, that's a great question. I think it's a dialectic. I think in California you're almost going to be at the end. I think California is unbelievable. It is Asian fusion. We're going to fuse everything. We will have gene pools. We won't even need DNA traces for everyone to know that they come from everywhere. On the other hand, back closer to our own neck of the woods, or even up in the Northeast, the Latinoization of both neighborhoods and of American popular culture is going to make for yet another chapter where salsa becomes, as I say one moment, it is no longer a condiment, but in fact a dance form, and a dance form that is so magnificent that everybody will want to participate.
Tom Ferraro, thank you very much. Tom Ferraro is Associate Professor of English at Duke and author of the book Feeling Italian. Now, you wouldn't guess it from looking at our new producer, Katie Barron, but she's half Italian. And in putting together today's show, she came to a few conclusions about ethnicity and her own identity.
My dishwasher blonde hair and blue eyes do nothing to evoke the mother country. Olive describes my favorite pizza topping, not my complexion. My pale skin turns various shades of pink in the sun. I'm pretty even-tempered. Sometimes I'm shy. I'm not prone to outbursts or tantrums or melodrama, not even when I'm watching the UNC Duke game. But with a name like Salderini, there's no denying my Italian heritage. In fact, when I pronounce it authentically, my full name is Caterina Angelina Salderini. My parents broke ranks with the family and moved my brother, sister, and me out of New Jersey when we were just kids. I grew up in North Carolina, land of milk-toasty surnames such as Johnson, Alexander, and Rogers. Growing up, my distinctive last name was an ethnic badge that associated me with organized crime, impetuousness, and tacky hair and makeup. That is to say, it gave an otherwise generic white girl some street cred. In junior high, I impressed my friends with insults from my grandparents' native dialect. To this day, the only two sentences I can say in their mother tongue roughly translate as, "You have a nose as flat as a rock," and "Your behind is wide enough for two women." My grandparents would have been ashamed to know how I embraced the Italian stereotypes they tried so hard to distance themselves from. They were flag-waving American patriots who hated Frank Sinatra for linking Italians with the mafia. By the time I got married, they were too old to make the trip down south. They weren't there when, faster than you can say I do, my Italian identity was usurped as I took my husband's WASPy last name. It's a good thing, too, because Old Blue Eyes was on the playlist at the reception. These days, I go by Katie Barron. With a cheery sorority girl name like that, I might as well curtsy when I introduce myself. But I've accepted it. My children's link to their Italian heritage will be weaker than overcooked pasta, but I'm proud that, if nothing else, they too will know how to say, "She has a nose as flat as a rock," in their great-grandparents' native tongue.
I've got you under my skin.
Katie Barron joined the production staff of The State of Things recently, and we're very happy to have her. Just ahead, a visit with Bill Moyers. Tomorrow on The State of Things, we'll broadcast the speech he gave earlier this week in Greensboro. Bill Moyers is next. Stay with us. I've got you.